Tonight is a very fortunate and timely event. The title of the event is The US Election Outcome, Implications for the Australian-US Alliance and the Indo-Pacific. And we're very fortunate to have Professor the Honourable Stephen Smith to present to us tonight. He's a great friend of the Institute. This is his university. He is one of a very few people who became, with his 20 years, 1993 to 2013, I think, Stephen, in Parliament, during which time he was Defence Minister, Foreign Minister, Trade Minister. There are very few people who've been Foreign Minister and Defence Minister at the same time. Stephen's famous for many things. He was a pioneer of the Indo-Pacific concept and used it in practice, introduced it to this part of the world, really. So I'm sure that'll come up. But also, I think we all have very fond memories of Condoleezza Rice visiting Perth and I think went back to your place for a cup of tea or something like that. So very close to people on a how foreign affairs works on a personal level. Stephen's now Professor of Public International Law at the University of Western Australia, and that goes with his background, because his background was very much international law, and that included a Master's at the University of London and lecturing and tutoring at the University of London in international law as well. He's also Chair of the Advisory Board at the Perth US Asia Centre. So without further ado, if I could hand over to Stephen, and he'll tell us where we are in this part of the world right now. Thanks, Stephen.
Well, thanks, John. Thanks very much for that kind introduction a very youthful photo of a former foreign minister up on the wall, which bears no relationship to modern-day reality. The Condoleezza Rice story was we had a cup of coffee in Mount Lawley at the family's favourite coffee shop, and I got mum and dad to come, and Jane, my wife, and Hugo, our son. And Hugo originally wasn't going to come, but he came, and he got Condi to sign his late notice for school. And we were chatting. I said, "Condi, you know, what do you, Madam Secretary, what do you feel like to drink?" So he wandered up to the barista. She said, "Actually, what I really feel like," I said, "well, I'm in a large cup. I just want just black coffee." I said, "Well, that's easy. That's one of our specialties. Just unfortunately here, Madam Secretary, they call that a long black." anyway, we're up there, and I do the orders, and I say, "Madam Secretary, would you mind just staying here for just 20 seconds by yourself?" I go back to the table. I say, "Dad, you got any cash on you?" So he handed over a 50, the change to which he never saw. You know, telling again that all politics is both local and personal. So, firstly, John, thanks very much for the introduction, and thanks very much for the invitation to speak to you as the warm-up for your Christmas party. I greatly admire the work that the AAAA does, both in WA and nationally. It makes a significant contribution to our international relations and foreign policy and national security thought, and so more power to your arm. You should continue to do that. I acknowledge the members of the Consular Corps and former parliamentary colleagues here this evening, but thank you all for taking an interest in what's a very important part of our national fabric. I want to, I'm going to put my timer on here. I want to make sure I don't go too far over time, because there's so much content and so much talent in the subject matter that I do want to give us a chance for a bit of a conversation. But I wanted, and the topic is, what are the implications for the Biden victory for Australia, the alliance, and for the Indo-Pacific and the world? And I think they're significant. But I want to start with a historical point, which is how things would have been if Hillary Clinton had won the 2016 election. See, we never focus much on the lost opportunity. What was the cost of that decision? And from an Australian and Indo-Pacific perspective, I think it's significant. So I had the great privilege of working closely with Condoleezza Rice, as we've spoken about, but also with Hillary Clinton, both as Secretaries of State, with Hillary as Foreign Minister and also as Defence Minister. And anyone who worked closely with her could never understand the public view of her. She was intelligent, she was warm, she was conscientious, she was forensic, she knew everything, she listened carefully, and she made sensible judgments after she'd listened to a whole range of views. And that enabled Australia to help persuade her that the United States should enter into the Treaty of Amity and Comity, that the United States should sign up for the East Asia Summit. And whilst most people look at the period of time within which I was in government as the formation of the G20 at leaders level as being the most significant international institutional change, in very many respects, I think the single biggest institutional change that Australia helped support and effect, with help obviously from ASEAN, particularly Singapore and Indonesia, was getting the United States into the East Asia Summit. Because that plus the so-called pivot, Marines in Darwin and the like, anchored the US into the Pacific and into the Indian Ocean. And so in very many respects, that was the architectural change which will continue to serve us very well. If Clinton had been elected, we would have had a president who was all over the Indo-Pacific, knew all of that, and I think that some of the arrangements that we entered into between Australia and the United States, not just Marines rotating through Darwin, but great utilisation of our bear bases in the north and northeast, Learmonth and Curtin in Northern Territory in Queensland, also greater utilisation of HMAS Stirling south of Perth as a port for engagement with US Navy, which would potentially lead to engagement with US and Indian Navy. So a lot of those opportunities have essentially gone into freeze frame for 4 years. I'm hopeful that Biden, who was shoulder to shoulder with Obama and Clinton on the Indo-Pacific pivot and those changes, will take those things up again. Different personalities, different emphasis, but nonetheless, there's some confidence that that body of work will be taken up again. So I think there's an opportunity cost that we don't often contemplate. The greatest emotion I think that most people felt when it became clear a few days after the election that Biden was going to be successful was simply one of relief. When Trump was elected, I was teed up before the election to do an op-ed for one of the papers, and of course I'd put my sort of, you know, Clinton wins draft, you know, in the computer long before, and on sort of 4 hours sort of notice I had to change it to Trump. And so I said, well, look, you know, Trump's the president. His initial comments were, you know, okay, but you need to understand the presidency is more than just one individual. There's a whole sort of raft of levels. As an American interlocutor once said to me, you know, the presidency is a bit like a franchise that operates at a whole range of levels. There might be McDonald's headquarters, but there are a whole range of corner stores out in the back blocks. And so we were confident that even if Trump became a difficult customer, that the franchise would continue to operate. And whilst Australia had its moments with Trump, particularly when Malcolm Turnbull was Prime Minister and the famous phone call and the like, as a general proposition, I thought Malcolm and his government and the government that followed him did a good job of making sure that, having got over a difficult moment with Trump and done that as well as anyone could, we then basically kept our head down and let the franchise operate. So the day-to-day mechanics of the alliance continued. You know, the usual exchanges, the usual working with Indo-Pacific Command and the like. And we were able to sustain that and did much better than some of the other United States allies who were treated very badly. And at various times, Korea, Japan, the Europeans, and NATO in particular. So we did better than most of the United States allies. But it became clear that 4 years of a Trump administration you might regard as a difficulty, 8 years of Trump would change the world in ways in which you would not be able to unwind. So relief at at Biden's election, and also the knowledge that with Biden and the people he's now choosing around him, you're essentially going to have a mainstream United States administration. So there are a range of difficulties that we had day to day with the Trump administration. You'll remember the never Trumpers, so people who were from the United States foreign policy, intelligence and national security community, who essentially said, you know, I may or may not be a Republican, and I've worked for governments before, Republican, sometimes Republican, Democrat, but I'm not going to work for this president. That took out of play hundreds of people who would normally fill the roles that are filled on a change of government. So right to the very end, you had roles that had never been filled. So we get to see the high-profile appointments. You know, we get to see who becomes Secretary of Defense, who becomes the National Security Advisor, who becomes the Secretary of State. But underneath that, there are a whole layer of political or policy professionals who fill the Deputy Assistant Secretary's job, who become the Assistant Secretary for East Asia, who become the Deputy Assistant Secretary for South Asia. And these are all really important positions. They'll all now be filled by competent, reliable people. And one great thing about the body of people that Biden has indicated he's proposing to nominate or to put in these positions, they've all cut their teeth in 8 years of the Obama administration. They've all cut their teeth as deputy chiefs of staff or deputy this or deputy that, and now they're stepping up. And the ones who we will deal with, Secretary of State, National Security Advisor, Defense Secretary, are generally the proposed Defense Secretary. Lloyd Austin is not as well known generally. He is well known by the ADF out of Iraq. But Tony Blinken and Jake Sullivan, National Security Advisor Sullivan and Secretary of State Blinken, they're well known to Australian officials. And they'll be stepping up, and they step up to those roles without any ego. One great thing about the group of people he's got is that none of them are on the make for another job. There's a great Australian tradition, which is if you want to get yourself promoted, do the job you've been given well. There's an American tradition of I'm in this job to get to the next one. The people who have been chosen aren't on the make for another job. This is not critical of John Kerry. I raised an eyebrow when Kerry was nominated as the climate change ambassador, not because of anything other than all of the other appointments and announcements were forward-looking, not backward-looking. And that, to me, was the only discordant voice, but Kerry's very experienced. So from an alliance perspective, all of that infill makes life very easy for Australia. And when Malcolm had his phone call with Trump, and there was disputation about that, all of the Congress, both House and Senate support, all of the institutional US support for the Australian alliance came to the fore. So perversely, we got more publicity for the alliance when Trump was president than we normally would. So in terms of the Australia relationship, I think the alliance will go back to sort of normal operating procedures. I think for the United States as other alliance, so we only have one ally, the United States. We have plenty of partners, but the hub and spoke hub and spoke model of US alliance arrangements, they have a range of alliances, NATO with Europe, but as diverse as Japan, Korea, the Philippines, etc., all of whom had their moments and difficulties. So for the US alliance partners and for Australia's partners in the Indo-Pacific, again, a sigh of relief that Trump has gone and the knowledge that relations might get back to normal in terms of the way in which you're dealt with. No surprises, cordial treatment and the like, which is very much Biden's forte. So I think for Australia, for the Indo-Pacific and the world generally, the uncertainty, the temperature will just go down a bit. On China, I don't necessarily think that Biden is going to adopt a different policy approach. I'll make some more remarks on China, but he might just manage to be more nuanced and more sophisticated and open up to more conversations. Like any country, China is not a monolith. It's currently it's a changed China. It's a much more assertive, aggressive and authoritarian China than Australia dealt with from 1972 pretty much to 2013, 2014. But it's not a monolith, and there's never any point in not talking to someone. currently when you talk to China, if China takes a different view, it's not much of a conversation. So Biden will be, I think, a bit more sophisticated, a bit more nuanced. Whether that sees any progress or changed approach so far as China is concerned, time will tell. So opportunity cost lost with Clinton not being elected. Australia managed to survive that 4 years just. 8 years would have been too much for all of us. And now a chance for Biden to prepare or to repair, essentially, the damage done to various alliance partners. If you look at what are the challenges that Biden is going to have when he formally takes office 21 January, they are deep and they are significant. And you could actually forgive him for not being able to pay all that much attention to international matters. Firstly, he's going to have COVID. COVID, where people are now dying in the United States on a daily rate greater than the casualties and fatalities from the Twin Towers. So now into the 3,000s. So he's going to inherit that, and that'll be a very big burden. Hopefully, he'll be able to persuade governors and populations to take some sensible precautions. Vaccine may help, but that's going to be a terrible difficulty for him in his first 100 days and potentially beyond. He's going to inherit a country where there is a significant divide. If you just stand back and look for the moment at when Trump was elected, why did Trump get himself elected? He got himself elected because he took over internally the Republican Party, and on top of the Republican Party vote, he added the vote of people who, in my view, fell into two categories. People who were completely alienated from society. Some people have called them the deplorables or misfits or misogynists or sexists or racists or whatever. But there was a second group of people, and these were a group of people, most of whom come from what we would call rural and regional America. They come from small population centres, they come from counties, and they come from rural and regional areas and counties where jobs have gone, opportunities have gone, prosperity has gone, and their view of the American dream for them and their families seemed to have disappeared forever. Democrats had failed them, Republicans had failed them, so here was someone who looked like he might shake the show up. And so there's a big policy challenge there for Biden, which is how do I bring those economically disenfranchised Americans back into a mainstream view where they think they do have a chance of the American dream, that if their children do what they did, which was get a better education than their parents, work hard, they'll have the chance of prospering. And you can see it in the electoral map. You see the Democrats' stronghold down the western seaboard leaking into sort of Arizona. You see the Democrats' stronghold on the northeast seaboard. And then in the middle, it's all red. It's all red. And when you break up the county vote, In the sea of red, you go to the capital city of a state. Biden gets a respectable vote, might be 40%, might be 50%, might be 60%. You drive a very short period of time. You know, you're just across the Narrows Bridge, and you're as far away as Bicton, and it's 20 Biden, 80 Trump, because it doesn't take long before you're away from the population centre, and there's no future, there's no economic hope, there's no this, there's no that. I think that's the big domestic economic challenge for him. How does he repair that relationship? So he's got COVID, he's got repairing that, he's got a big race divide, and he's got a president in his lame duck period who's being anything other than a lame duck. He's deliberately doing everything he can to trash institutions, to further divide the country, to stoke fuel for the fire, potentially with a view to him or a family member having another go in 2024. So that's a very difficult environment for him to lead into. And at the same time, he'll have everyone from NATO to China knocking on the door to try and deal with global issues. His single biggest challenge in terms of international relations will, of course, be China. And so if we stand back and look at China, not so much from the Australian perspective, but from a US perspective. In my experience, the single biggest historical support group for China to emerge as a member of the global community, for China to emerge as an economic power, to remove hundreds of millions of people from poverty, which China has done, which is a fantastic achievement. The strongest support group for that in the United States historically was what is called the America-China Business Association. Very strongly supportive. So thousands of members, all of whom have dealt with Chinese companies, had their own companies established in China over long periods of time. The last time I was in Washington, which obviously not this year, but 2019, I was at a meeting where the then sort of secretary or CEO of that organisation was present, and we were chatting about China and a changed China, and he leant over the table and said, we've been the strongest support group for engagement with China. 80% of my members now won't have anything to do with China. What was once a very strong sort of economic and trade relationship is now pretty much a smouldering ruin. And I said, is this driven by economics, driven by commercial collaboration, or is it driven by security issues or cyber issues? To which the response was, it's all commercial, it's all stealing of intellectual property, breaking of contracts and the like. And so what was once the biggest lobby group is now strongly opposed to further engagement. So Biden's got a chance, I think, to try and see if he can, in a nuanced way, get back to a conversation with China. And why do I say China has changed? Well, for many years, and Australia has always been well regarded by China for an early move to, Whitlam went to China, was widely condemned for doing so. 2.5 weeks later, Kissinger and Nixon went, so the world changed. But China has always appreciated that Australia recognised China with a one China policy when it wasn't necessarily sort of popular or fashionable to do so. And from 1973 on, with formal recognition from the Whitlam government, all the way through, there's been a good relationship and the economic and the trade cycle has grown. So, and when we, post-World War II, through, in the main, US investment into minerals and petroleum resources, established our Northeast Asian export markets in iron ore, coal on the eastern seaboard, and then LNG. They were never in the first instance aimed at China. It was all about Japan and Korea. And then when China came along and grew, the opportunities for iron ore, coal, and LNG came to China. And it's only been as late as 2009 that China became our largest trading partner. So China's been our largest trading partner for less than a decade. But throughout that period, we had the capacity to have our cake and eat it too. We had a security relationship with the United States, and we had a growing economic relationship with China, which was part of our Northeast Asia export industries. And with a couple of successive minerals and petroleum resource booms out of China, the China relationship now superficially dwarfs anything we do with Japan or Korea, although we continue, in my view, to underappreciate the significance of the economic relationship that we continue to have with Japan, which in an investment sense continues to grow, and also a long-standing security and strategic relationship we have with Japan, which also continues to grow. So we should not forget that for many decades, Japan was Australia's strongest supporter in the Asia-Pacific, wanting Australia to become part of a range of Asia-Pacific forums. And so I think too often we ignore and forget the fact that Japan's been a deeply significant friend, a deeply significant economic partner, and now a growing and deeply significant security and strategic partner. We have the best security and strategic relationship with Japan than any country does other than the United States itself. But when we look now at China. We were all optimistic when Xi Jinping became president. We knew him well. We dealt with him over a reasonable period of time, both in his capacity as a provincial leader, then as vice president. But we've seen since really 2013 to 2014 a much more aggressive, assertive, and potentially confrontational China. Now, if you look at the post-World War II world, the United States becomes a superpower in competition ideologically with the Soviet Union. After a period of time, the Soviet Union collapses, and for a nanosecond, the United States becomes the sole and single great power. And then China is on the rise, and so we now have this bipolar world with what I call a Cold War with economic characteristics. Because when the Soviet Union collapsed, there was intense military competition between the United States and the Soviet Union. There was also intense military collaboration and consultation because with the overpreponderance of nuclear weapons, the risk of miscalculation was far too great. So they had a deeply ingrained political and military conversation, but no economic conversation whatsoever. And Australia has next to no economic relationship with Russia then or with the Soviet Union then or now. So when the Soviet Union collapsed economically, it was an economic collapse for the Soviet Union per se, but not for the rest of the world. With the US and China, you've got over 200 countries in the world where China is the largest trading partner. So a contest, a potential small C Cold War brings with it deeply significant economic characteristics. So the US economy is inextricably interwoven with the Chinese economy, just as the Australian trade economy is inextricably over-dependent upon China. So as we manage our way through, what is the desirable outcome that we'd want? Well, certainly we would want China to return to much more of what Bob Zelick described as a responsible stakeholder and Deng Xiaoping described as the consensus, which is we're not going to change our system, but we will play by the global rules of the road. So that's going to be Biden's most significant challenge. Whether he can make progress, time will tell. It requires conversation on the US part, but also conversation on China's part. When it comes to Australia, the single biggest support for the Australia-China relationship continues to be Australian business, and that's understandable, our largest trading partner. But I think we've gone well past the time where whatever issues we have with China can be solved or addressed by responding to calls from sections of the business community to quote, be nice to China. China's made it clear that we're being economically punished. We're not being punished by any legitimate trade dispute. We're being economically punished for things, policies we've adopted or positions that we've taken domestically or globally. And if you look at the famous list of 14 demands which the Chinese embassy gave to the newspapers, you go down that list of 14 demands, you ask yourself the question, well, which of these things can Australia recant on in any respectable way, which is in our national interest to do so? And my score is 0 out of 14. So, yes, it is true that the government of the day, like every government of the day, I can make that concession now where current participants can't. The government of the day has made a number of tactical mistakes which, inverted commas, haven't helped. But in the end, it doesn't get over the fundamental change of approach that China takes, the demands which China is making on policy of Australia, and the things which China is doing which cause Australia to react in a way which is in its national and national security interests. So we've been lucky for a period of time. We've had our cake and we've been able to eat it too. And if you look at those areas of trade where China has, inverted commas, taken trade action, they're all areas where China can take action against Australia's exports but suffer no damage itself because there's an easy way of replacing it. The one thing it can't replace at the moment is, of course, iron ore. But don't think that China is not thinking about diversification. So Brazil is in trouble. China is working with Brazil on trying to build the world's biggest iron ore containers to minimise the transportation cost from Brazil to China. It's also working on a number of iron ore deposits in Africa to try and get different and a range of iron ore supply to China. And as soon as the current China, because China can and hopefully will change, as soon as the current China has got diversity of supply so far as iron ore is concerned, it will move away from Australian iron ore. Now, that may take a number of years, but under the current environment, as soon as night follows day, it will do that. So the biggest challenge for Australia in terms of its China relationship, to me, is what I call project diversification. if you're running an export business and all of your eggs are in one basket, then any company, any country, any individual will say, we're highly risk averse here, we need to diversify. And so what Australia now needs to do, I think our biggest challenge, and this was our biggest challenge, whether it was a Trump administration or a Biden administration, and Biden administration makes it much easier for us, our biggest challenge in my view remains, how do we diversify away from the export industries that we developed post-World War II, starting in 1957 with a manufacturing agreement with Japan, which has been the mainstay of our prosperity ever since, and in particular in the late 1990s until now, has really been the icing on the cake. And so if you look at not just in the China context, but what do we export to Northeast Asia? Thermal coal. No one is investing in thermal coal anymore because it's not ESG compliant. It's not socially acceptable to invest in thermal coal anymore. So people are moving away from thermal coal. Metallurgical coal has a longer lifeline. Metallurgical coal and iron ore both utilised in the making of steel, but at some point in the cycle, someone will crack the making of steel without utilising either metallurgical coal or iron ore. So, and LNG, I've always been of the view that gas was the transitional fuel to take us to renewables, but LNG, which is significant for Australia as the world's largest LNG producer and exporter, is also on a downhill trend line. So if you look at the prosperity that we saw post-World War II to now, it was basically coal, Northeast Asia, iron ore, Northeast Asia, LNG, Northeast Asia. Well, all of those exports, although you can get a differential trend line for thermal versus metallurgical coal, what's the trend line? They're all like this. Not going to happen overnight. Thermal coal will go first, but that is all going to happen over the next 30 years. Now, it took us 30 years to work out how we could create export industries to Japan and Korea and subsequently China, although China, as I said earlier, was not in contemplation at the time. So we need to start now the planning to set the scene for the next 30 years for those things which will replace that prosperity. Because if we don't replace them and add to them, then our prosperity necessarily must fall, which is not what we had in mind. And so what are the opportunities? To me, the opportunities have always been in what we call the Indo-Pacific. And so when Peter Varghese and I and others started to articulate as Australian foreign and national security policy the notion of the Indo-Pacific, what we had in mind was that the world was changing. That, yep, the United States was the world's largest economy. It may well be overtaken by China, but there are other economies and other nations and other large population centres on the rise. Indonesia, 300 million people. Every respectable calculation has Indonesia as the fourth largest economy by 2050. Further west, India, on the rise, same population as China, better age demographic, will be the second or third largest economy by 2050. So that caused us to say, we talk about the Asia Pacific, which gets the United States, gets China, but what about the Indian Ocean and the Indian Ocean Rim? What about India? What about Indonesia? And so the notion of the Indo-Pacific was driven initially by where's our economic prosperity going to come from? And so that's why we started to say we need to devote more attention to India, more attention economically to Indonesia. We've had a very good relationship with Indonesia. The fact that Indonesia is a country is of itself a marvel. We've had over our ups and downs, but generally we've had a very good strategic security relationship with Indonesia. Where we've failed with Indonesia is we've never transformed the proximity and the relationship into trade and investment. And the same is true with India. From a Western Australian perspective, we had a better trade relationship with India 20 years ago than we do now. So growing an economic relationship, a trade and investment relationship with India, with Indonesia, and other growing ASEAN tigers, in particular Vietnam, is where, to me, the most opportunities lie. But if we don't start planning and acting for that now, when those trend lines become a cliff, then our domestic economic problems will come home to roost. And our domestic economic structural issue has always been we're a large landmass country and continent. We've got a half a dozen scattered population centres, variously between 6 and 2 million capital cities, but we have no critical mass, which is why we've always said our way through this is to do things in a world-class way, products, services, endeavours, which we can utilise in a population centre. So China has 1.4 billion people. That's critical mass. What can we do for them? Indonesia, 300 plus million. What can we do with Indonesia? India, 1.4. What can we do with India? What can we do with India? So to me, the single biggest challenge is how do we get project diversification underway? And it's going to be much harder than what we did with Japan and Korea. Japan essentially came to Australia and said, we need to rebuild our nation and our economy. We need your resources. The only resources that people contemplated in that era were fossil sources. We need your coal. We need your iron ore. We need energy sources and building sources so that we can rebuild our country and rebuild a great economy. And that was relatively easy. Neither India nor Indonesia nor Vietnam want any of those commodities now or into the future. So what are the things that we can do in a world-class way that is attractive to those countries? And so pretty easy to work out, okay, coal, iron ore, subsequently LNG to Japan, to Korea and then China. But what can we do which can get critical mass in India, in Vietnam, in Indonesia? To me, that's our single biggest challenge. Now, that's sort of around the world for sixpence in 33 minutes. And there's another half an hour if I looked at my notes. But I think because it's the AIIA, John, and because people will be interested and have views, why don't we just go straight to questions? And if I look at my notes and I've forgotten something I should have told them, I can tell them over questions.
Well, that's great.
Thanks very much.
Thanks very much, Stephen. Wonder if we can do Q&A. And look, just bear in mind, the good news is, because I think that was an obviously outstanding tour of the horizon, and we will be podcasting and broadcasting, thanks to Ash up there, so it'll have a deeper and broader reach. So with questions and answers, if I could just ask as a courtesy, can we use the microphone? Because we are podcasting. And it's over there. And just as a courtesy, if you wouldn't mind just introducing yourselves for our speaker and for everyone else, and welcome to make observations, but, you know, relatively pithy questions. So can I see the first hand up is right in the middle, and then Natalie. So microphone over here. Thanks, Cameron.
Thanks, Stephen. That was a very wonderful round-the-world trip without any tickets, without any COVID alerts, so that was good to see. Prashant Singh, I'm the National Secretary for Council of Indian Federation of Australia, and also Secretary for Federation of Indian Association. My work directly relates to working with diaspora community, and in September I presented to the WA Parliament how we can enhance trade relationship between India and WA. And we talked about the key areas. Some of the recommendation I did is in the final report as well. So my question goes back to, we have 700,000 Indian diaspora across Australia. What role they can play in terms of enhancing that relationship, which is growing every day?
Yeah. Well, Prashant, firstly, thanks for turning up. Thanks for your interest in the Australia-India relationship and the effort you put into that. Look, I think the Indian diaspora in Australia is one of the deeply significant things which will help propel the relationship. So the diaspora is on track to get to 1 million people within the next couple of years. So 1 million people out of 25 or 26 million is significant. And we know from every country where there's an Indian diaspora that the Indian diaspora takes an interest in public policy, in community affairs, in politics, and also takes an enduring interest in India itself. So I think presence of the diaspora will be deeply significant. Just by coincidence, yesterday, with wearing my Perth US Asia Centre cap, we had a session with Australia's Consul General Designate to Chennai. Yes. And around that table, you'd have been surprised, the Indian and Chennai expertise in the room from 10 people living and working in Western Australia was absolutely phenomenal. Part of that was diaspora-based, but I never cease to sort of be surprised by what rocks you kick over where you discover someone doing something with India, Indonesia or Vietnam that no one knows anything about. So we're starting to grow in Western Australia that sort of mass of Indian interest in what we're doing. So the last election, there were two members of parliament of Indian origin who were both elected for the first time in our state's history. That's fantastic. There's been some really good work that's been done at three levels on the relationship. So we have the Varghese report, which was published some time ago, which essentially says you can't, you know, like the Swedes used to say about the elephant, you can't eat it whole. You've got to break it down into industry verticals, but also states or provinces. So what don't think you go to Delhi and solve all your problems. You've actually got to get down the ground. Most of the economic power and decisions is in the states. So what works? And so from a Western Australian perspective, you can see where the sister state relationships are, where the opportunities might be. So that body of work by Peter Varghese has been out for a couple of years. Varghese had McKinsey help him do that work. One of the McKinsey guys has been living and working in Perth for the last 6 years. He was crucial to that piece of work, and he's now about to go back home to Chennai. But immediately you've got, you know, a de facto second consul general in Chennai because you've got someone like him going back. The next big body of work is Ambassador Wadhwa's economic study, which was due to be released yesterday, but the relevant Indian Chamber of the relevant Indian commerce industry was unavailable at the last minute, so that's been put off for a week or so. But once Wadhwa's report is out, and this is, so Varghese's report was, what are the economic opportunities for Australia in India? Wadhwa's report is the reciprocal, which is, what are the Indian opportunities, economic opportunities in Australia? Once that's out, then you've got to join up the matrix, and then we've got to say to the Commonwealth and to the various states, whether it's WA or Victoria, this is how the matrix goes, this is where the opportunities are, now we must make this a priority. In the end, when we grew the relationship with Japan, that sort of post-World War II manufacturing relationship through the Trade and Manufacturing Compact of 1957, when we did that, you had Commonwealth leaders, state leaders and business leaders waking up every day, both in here and in Japan, waking up every day saying, what am I doing today to get this thing over the line? And that's what we don't have now with India or Indonesia. We don't have senior leaders in the Commonwealth or in business waking up every day saying, what am I doing today to get a trade and investment relationship with India over the line? And a very simple thing. So having done the economic study with India, not rocket science to say, well, why don't we do the same thing with Indonesia? Why don't we find someone, you know, Varghese was terrific. He was a former high commissioner there. You know, there must be some former ambassador to Indonesia or someone who headed up the DFAT desk or someone in business. Let's do an Australian study of the Indonesian economy. Because there's only one way that Indonesia will respond to that. It's in a classic Javanese way, which is, well, you did a study on us, looks like we have to do a study on you. But that just seems to be beyond the current government. Maybe a new trade minister might help that. But there are so many little things that we can do. But if we don't, in the end, have leaders from the Commonwealth saying to business and business saying to itself, this is now our highest priority, economic, trade and investment diversity, growing relationships with different partners in the Indo-Pacific, with India, with Indonesia, with Vietnam, consolidating what we're doing with traditional partners as well. Doesn't mean you walk away from China as a trading partner or walk away from your current obligations. It just means you've got to find new markets because the world is changing. And even if China was going steamingly well, even if China was not a problem for us, that downhill trend line for what we've relied upon since the 1950s, it's on the way out, and the rest of the world are doing different things. What are we doing to do different things which will secure and maintain our prosperity?
Thank you, Stu.
Now, my hand is just behind you to Natalie, and then the next one's Robert up there.
Hi, Stephen. Thanks for that. It's Natalie Sambi, Executive Director of Verve Research and non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution. Stephen, I just want to go from trade to security for a moment. You mentioned General Lloyd Austin's appointment as Secretary of Defence. What are your comments about, you know, Michelle Flournoy, arguably the most qualified potential Secretary Def in favour of Lloyd Austin? And given that there's a moment where there appears to be a lot of former military generals being appointed in positions either of Minister of Defence or Secretary of Defence, what do you think the impact might be on things like the 2+2, you know, with Osman meetings, or is it advantageous to engagement in the region given Indonesia and Philippines and a bunch of other countries have MINDEFs who are former army generals? Thanks.
Well, I've worked closely with Michelle Fournier. I've got the highest regard for her, and personally I was disappointed that she wasn't announced as the nominee. I don't know Lloyd well or at all. There are a number of people I've spoken to already who do. In the first instance, he has to get through the Armed Services Committee because he's a former serving officer. 7 years needs to elapse before he can be appointed to essentially a civilian position. There's been one exemption given in the past for Jim Mattis, and a number of the then committee members who are still serving committee members said at the time, this is the only one we'll do. And they did it because they said to themselves, well, we like Mattis, and maybe given the difficulties that we're seeing in the Trump administration, Jim might actually help. And for a long time, Mattis was seen as sort of the hope of the side and the go-to person for the allies, etc. Will the Armed Services Committee be able to stare down the first black American nominee for Defence Secretary? It's a big call. So I think he'll be appointed, and I'm just hoping that someone is smart enough to say to Michelle, why don't you take the first deputy's job? You can be an Ash Carter, and you never know how things unfold.
The impact on civil military relations for Australia?
I don't think, from our perspective, no great impact. Like we've dealt with a variety of defence secretaries and Secretary of State over the period. I don't think it'll have any great impact. It's a pretty mature relationship. I had the great pleasure to deal with Gates, whose photo's on the wall, and with mental blank now, it's a worry, isn't it? Jim Panetta. And they're all class acts. So I'm not, from our perspective, I'm not worried. It sends a different connotation in some of our partners. You made the point about Indonesia. There is some historical sort of cross currents about that, but for us, it's not an issue, I don't think.
Robin McClellan. Thanks, and then Samina. Any other? And then Brendan.
Hi, I'm Robin McClellan. Stephen, far be it from me to weigh in and correct you on anything. But I have 2 points. One is a point and the other is a question. First one is, you mentioned very early in your remarks about the never-Trumpers and the foreign policy establishment leaving when Trump came in. And I, not surprisingly, feel a bit of loyalty because many, many of them didn't leave of their own accord. They left because they were forced out. Our U.S. State Department's personnel structure means that when a new administration comes in, everyone, career appointees as well as political appointees at a certain level, submit their resignations. Normally, the career appointees' resignations are not accepted. If they are, there's only a certain number of time for those appointees to be placed in another position at a similar level, if not, they're forced out. quite often at a time in their lives when they have kids in university, which is a very pricey activity in the United States. And it was devastating to a whole generation of Foreign Service officers who didn't leave because, you know, we know when we sign up that we are signing up to serve an elected government, and they didn't make a decision on their own to leave. Some did, but most were actually forced out. So I just wanted to make that point on behalf of my former colleagues. Secondly, I think you've raised so many good points about what does Australia do now? How do we look for other opportunities? How do we strengthen these relationships? And I think one of the areas Australia was very successful at was services exports, as in education. And of course, COVID has meant that that's really been damaged. That those markets have been damaged in the last few months. Do you think, from your point of view, and you work with universities as well as your other roles, do you think that we'll be able to get that confidence and those markets back?
Well, on, I accept everything you say on the first point. If I said left, the ones I had in mind were the ones who signed the adverts, which was basically saying we'll never serve. And I accept there were, you know, acknowledge there were a whole range of professional public servants in state who were treated badly, who put their country first, as they often do. And I can't remember the incident, but I can remember Jim Caruso here as acting ambassador in the face of an onslaught from the president about the quality of the Foreign Service, standing up bravely and courageously, speaking on behalf of the same people you've spoken up. And I've always been an admirer of Jim, but my admiration grew even more with that contribution. On international education, I spoke about the Indian report. Peter Varghese holds international education as sort of, is, if you like, a potential backbone for the India relationship. It's one of the things that we've been very good at historically. We've created an industry out of nothing. We did, I think, make the mistake for a period of time in thinking about our international education engagement as being only how many international students could we get, whereas the real success for international education comes not just from students that you have, but the collaboration between institutions, the research that you do, the joint research, etc. So we continue to have, although it's under pressure at the moment from COVID, from too many universities making the same mistake as other institutes have done, which is too many students from one source. But the basic fundamentals remain there. I listened with half an ear to an international education Zoom that was on this afternoon, which featured a number of the usual Australian education suspects. But I'm confident that we can rebound in that area. I'm confident that we've got a world-class expertise. In very many respects, we've got one university with 40-odd campuses around the country in terms of quality, given the way that we regulate the industry. And if you talk to or see the research from the parents who send their kids to Australia, historically our competitors have been US, UK and Canada, because very many of the kids who come here, their parents want them to get a high quality education, but also a high quality education in English. And so how we compare or compete US, UK, Canada is important to us. I did the ubiquitous Zoom thing a few weeks ago where there was myself and Alexander Downer as sort of the two sort of even-sided hacks and, you know, sort of X's. And Alexander is doing some work at King's College in London, and it was done at a time because they start their academic year September. So it was sort of end September when we did this from memory. And he was saying that they just had all of their returns in terms of overseas student applications and numbers. And he'd been very surprised that there was hardly a drop in the preceding year. So, which surprised me, but obviously was a very good sign for King's College and them. I think once we have got through our COVID issues, and for us it's not so much that there's COVID in the community, but we've used our borders sensibly to our international borders sensibly to constrain the spread. Once we've got to a position where we're able to open up our borders fully again and invite students to come, I think we'll rebound pretty quickly. Whether we can do it in a staggered way, in a sort of an agile and sort of a nuanced way between now and 2022, you know, time will tell. But it is one of those things that we're very good at. I've been an admirer of some of the things which governments after my time have done. So the second, inverted commas, Colombo plan was a very good initiative by Julie Bishop, because what we find is that if you give someone an education in Australia when they go back to their homeland, wherever it is, whether it's ASEAN, whether it's the United States, wherever it is, they essentially become an ambassador for Australia. And if you, and particularly the original Colombo plan, people who are educated, you know, or walk across the car park at the, so where the Perth US Asia Centre office is now, when I first came to UWA in the early 70s, that was the old Commerce Building, and you'd be knocked over in the rush from all of the students who were from ASEAN countries. And 20, 30, 40 years on, all of those people from various ASEAN countries are people of significance in their own countries, they're decision makers, and they warmly value the opportunity they got here. So it's a terrific soft power device for us, but it's also very good for us economically. I think we'll bounce back. I think it's one of our strengths, and it'll just be a matter of time, hopefully.
I think we've got time for two more, so Samina and then Brendan.
Thank you very much. It's Samina Yasmin from AIIA. I was just wondering if you could say something about Biden's possible policy, as you see it, vis-a-vis Iran and Saudi Arabia, and what would that mean for Australia?
Yeah, well, I don't follow as closely those issues as I used to, so I put that caveat. I think Biden will be a good influence on Saudi Arabia in terms of its robustness. I think of the things which Trump did, which the United States and the rest of the world lived or could live to regret. First was the US withdrawal from the TPP, which was a big economic and strategic mistake. So the fact you now have no India and RCEP and no US in TPP is deeply regrettable. But the second, other than the TPP, the turning over of the Iran deal, I think thought was deeply regrettable. Whether Biden thinks he's in a position to seek to restore that and therefore improve the relationship with Iran, time will tell. But I think his presence and his history on the Iran deal will be a net positive. Whether you can turn that into an outcome, time will tell.
Last question, Brendan.
Thank you very much, Stephen. One of life's regrets is I resigned from DFAT about 6 weeks before you took over as minister, and I went to Africa to try.
Some might say you were prescient.
And I went to West Africa to try and develop one of those iron ore mines to compete with the Pilbara, but it hasn't happened and it's still a long way from happening. But a couple of observations. I'll follow on from Prashant's comment. I actually had a little bit of an argument with Peter Varghese because in his report, he paints the diaspora as this kind of a magic solution to building the relationship. And he points to some examples, some case studies from peer countries like Canada, the US, and the UK, potentially even New Zealand. But unfortunately, the numbers don't do the talking when it comes to the diaspora and the Indian diaspora. And it's actually beyond 700,000 because if you include people of Indian descent from Malaysia, Singapore, Fiji, and the like, it has already exceeded 1 million people. And as a percentage of the population, we have an Indian heritage population here much larger than the US and even probably akin to Canada, much larger than the UK. But we have such low representation of this diaspora in the community, in leadership positions, in decision-making positions. Part of the reason is in politics, yes, the Indian community is engaged in politics, but the party system here doesn't allow them to compete in safe seats. You mentioned Yaz and Kevin Michel, the two state members. You would recall that they had swings of 20+% that they needed to get, so they were not safe Labour seats that they were pre-selected for. So when I mentioned that they were accidental politicians, they completely agreed with me. Whereas on the other side of the continent, the one person in the federal parliament of Indian descent, of course, was the former Senator Lisa Singh. And unfortunately, due to factional battles, she got put down the Senate ticket, and she managed to overcome that once by encouraging people to vote below the line, but it didn't happen the second time. So my question, I guess, is if you want to tap into this diaspora, if indeed, as in the Varghese report, it's something to tap into, there's something about the political system and the community and the society that doesn't see people of Indian background or even ethnic background as decision-making quality, having decision-making qualities or leadership qualities. And when you compare to like-minded countries like the US, Canada, UK, even France, Germany, you just do not see the numbers come up. So I guess that's a national question. I'd like to understand your thoughts about that, how you overcome that. And secondly, on Indonesia, what is really disappointing, I know you're a big fan of Indonesia. At the moment, I think it's the only Indonesian course at a university level in WA is being curtailed in Murdoch University. So when I joined the DFAT under the Keating years, Keating had a dream that 25% of Australians would be speaking Indonesian by now. That hasn't happened. It's very key, it's very important, but as a country, we don't seem to be able to encourage that outcome. So I guess two questions on the Indian diaspora and the Indonesian language. Thank you.
Well, let me try and unpack a bit of that. When I was an article clerk and I decided to finish off my arts degree here, I majored in South Asian history. And the South Asian History Department that we had in the arts faculty here was recognised then as the best South Asian History Department in the country, beating the ANU's department. And when the head of that department died tragically at an early age, we no longer have a South Asian History Department at UWA. And you can go through multiple examples of similar things around the country. We have less Indonesian speakers in Australia now than we did in the 1970s. We have less students enrolled speaking Indonesian in our schools than we did 20 years ago. And there have been multiple studies by various governments over various stages all making the same point. Recently there was a study by the Institute of Company Directors all making the point that in other jurisdictions, boards with diversity, particularly sort of cultural, language and expat or diaspora diversity, actually helps grow a company and an economy. So all those things you say are true, and we just have to keep at it, first point. Secondly, on pre-selections, I used to be responsible for Western Australian ALP state pre-selections, but fortunately that responsibility and obligation passed me by decades ago, so I can't comment on that or the Tasmanian pre-selections. But I'll make this general point. When I was a party official, I'd go to people of standing in the community, they'd be nurses, doctors, whatever they were, school teachers, and say, look, we've identified you as someone who is interested in your local community, has a view about public policy, wants to make your suburb, your city, your town, your world a better place. We think you'd be a good member of parliament. How about putting your name for it? How about let's have a plan? You can join a local branch, you can do this, you can do that. And people would say, I'd love to do that, and you could sort of guide people and help manoeuvre them through. And sure, it's easier to get someone who's not sort of an activist in the party pre-selection for a marginal seat than for a safe seat. And I did continue to do that when I was a Member of Parliament. By the time I got to the end of being a Member of Parliament, the response was generally, Stephen, I don't know why you do what you do, why you would suffer all of the things you suffer from the media, from the community, from your lack of salary to this or that. So here's the deal. If you can guarantee me that I'll get pre-selection for this seat, which I'll then win, and can immediately become a minister, then I'm up for it. Well, life's not like that. And so what I say, you know, I get here and elsewhere, I get young kids coming up saying, look, you know, can I have a cup of coffee with you? I'm interested in politics. I'd like to you know, go into parliament. And the first thing I always say to them is, well, firstly, who for? To which off, you know, 70% scratch their heads and say, well, I hadn't thought about that. So, well, go away and think about that and come back. And I don't mind if you come back saying I'd like to be an independent. but at least think about that. But then I say, okay, it's fantastic. Let me encourage you. But here's the deal. The first thing you have to do is you've actually got to give yourself a career, an expertise, something that you can do as a platform to become potentially a member of parliament, but also something to fall back on, because I regret to advise, more often than not, the dream doesn't materialise. And so when I was lucky from a very early age, the only thing I ever wanted to do was to be a member of parliament and to do things, you know, in policy and communities, etc. But I worked out that the best way to do that was to show people that you could do other things. If you could do the job you're doing well now, they might think of you in a different or a higher context. But I also worked out, if it doesn't work out, well then you can do one or two things. You can spend the rest of your life saying they never appreciated my greatness, or you can do other things. And when I was young and silly, I could only think that the only way you could make a contribution to society was by being a member of parliament, and particularly being a minister. Now, of course, I know that's just nonsense. People make fantastic public service, public policy, community contributions in a whole variety of ways, and they don't even know that there's a thing called politics or parliament. So there's a whole range of ways in which you can make a fantastic contribution. And often for many former members of parliament, the challenge is, well, what do I do now? It's not unlike the 32-year-old cricketer or footballer who's the peak of their career, or their last work is over when they're very young because they're an elite sportsman or sportswoman. So encouraging people to go into parliament is a good thing. It's much harder these days on both political parties, because both parties have as the basis of their talent pool, party activists. And so that immediately reduces diversity. On your key point, which is how do we get sort of the Indian diaspora members into parliament or into positions, again, you've just got to, it's, you know, it's 90% perspiration, 10% inspiration. It's finding people who want to do it. It's finding people who are prepared to roll the dice and who've got attributes which people will say, well, they'd be really good. The last time I checked the stats, which was in 2013 when I retired, it remained the case that the median, or, you know, when you go through how many members of the Australian Parliament, House of Reps, serve one term, serve two terms, etc., the biggest bundle remains one-termers. Right? That's the biggest bundle. Most people go into the parliament and go out. I used to have this rule. Colleagues would say, how come you never chat to those Libs? And I'd say, I only ever talk to them if they've done two terms. Right? They get back a second time, I'm happy to have a conversation. But most of it's wasted, you know. Like, and so when I retired, there were only on... I was there for 20 years, like it's a lifetime, but it goes in a blink of an eye. There were only on my side, on the Labor side, there are only three of us left who came in 1993. There were only three of us left from that intake, and there were 10 of us all up. There were three left, and there are none left. So the turnover is actually pretty quick. But you got to get out there and get active. You got to find the candidates. You got to join up. You got to do this. You got to do that. I don't think it's anything. It's not institutionalized. It's not. It's just. You know, I know the video's on. It's a terrible thing to say, but you know, as they used to say in the old days, you know, you know, you got to be active. You got to be involved.
I think we'll forego that. Well, thanks very much, Dave.
you probably clipped that last bit from the video. You know, like just
Okay. Well, look, thanks very much, Stephen. It's probably wise for me to hand over to Molly, our secretary, to give a vote of thanks, a formal vote of thanks. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, John. I know that we were all very grateful that you could join us here tonight, Stephen, and share your thoughts and experiences on everything from a potential alternative reality in 2016, should Hillary Clinton have taken office, all the way through to Australian trade and the challenges that we face in the future. It is my pleasure to present to you a signed copy of Dr. Sue Boyd's memoir, Not Always Diplomatic.